Shalom, welcome to SJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers, I am in a very upbeat mood this week because we just tried something new and it seems to be working out very well, especially for the Hebrew movement, especially for our campaign to reach more Israeli Jews. The great Shlomo, our great admin, is now doing cartoons for us. And he is so talented. His cartoon depictions are really absolutely better than the vast majority of people who do this professionally for newspapers. In the past, every newspaper used to have a cartoonist. Shlomo does cartoons on the same level as the most professional cartoonists, in my opinion. And so I'm very proud when I present this to English-speaking and Hebrew-speaking people as representative of our movement and our point of view. We have something we can be very proud of. Let me tell you first of all about the first two cartoons that we released to the public. The first cartoon had as its headline, "We are taking another step toward peace," quote-unquote, in the Middle East. That was the headline. "We're taking another step toward peace," quote-unquote, in the Middle East. And then you see a picture of Barack Hussein Obama and John Kerry stepping on Bibi Netanyahu. In other words, the next step toward peace in the Middle East is to once again step on Netanyahu. That's the Obama-Kerry idea of taking a step toward peace in the Middle East. That was the cartoon. And it was very well drawn and very well put together. So we got a great response, especially in Hebrew, especially from the Israeli Jews, we got a great response. And even from English-speaking people, they liked the cartoon. So this was very encouraging. Then, 24 hours ago, we released the second cartoon. After Shabbat, I released the second cartoon. The headline on the second cartoon was that Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister of Israel, Avigdor Lieberman, says Israel should accept the Kerry plan to retreat to the pre-1967 suicide borders and to surrender Jerusalem. That's what the headline is. It says, in other words, you read that headline in English, and to the Hebrew-speaking people would read it in Hebrew, that Lieberman says that Israel should accept the suicidal Kerry plan. Then it shows a picture of Lieberman holding a mirror and looking in the mirror. And Lieberman says as he's holding the mirror, and as he's holding the mirror, it says, Lieberman doesn't say this, but as he's holding the mirror, it says on the cartoon, "Whenever Lieberman looks in the mirror," and then you see the next window where it says, "This is what he always sees," and you see him holding the mirror and he sees a picture of Yariv Oppenheimer of Peace Now. In other words, when he looks in the mirror, he sees Yariv Oppenheimer from the radical left, self-hating Judenrat Kapo traitor organization Peace Now. That's what he sees when he looks in the mirror, meaning, of course, that he is the same thing as Oppenheimer and the same thing as Peace Now. And once again, we got great comments, especially from the Israelis. I mean, we got comments from the Israelis saying, "Oh, Shlomo is a genius. This is great. This is, wow, this is fantastic. You should have done this years ago." We should have done it years ago, but, you know, someone, one of the admins from our Hebrew forum, Rafo, who recently joined, by the way, the English forum as well, Rafo is the one who came up with this idea. He came up with the idea because he saw an Israeli Jewish cartoonist doing Hebrew cartoons on subjects in Israel, and he saw that it got a big response on Facebook. Well, guess what? Shlomo's cartoons are really, in my opinion, they're even better. I'm not going to say who this Israeli cartoonist was, but Shlomo's cartoons are so professional and are so good that we figured let's give Shlomo a chance because he, you know, we know that Shlomo is very talented. We've seen all of his very talented work on the Hebrew and English videos, and we've seen what he does on the forums and what a technical genius he is. So we figured, let's give him a chance also to work with cartoons because he also has tremendous artistic talent. And so we're very, very encouraged by this. Very, very encouraged by the response. Hundreds and hundreds, I mean, every day hundreds of Israeli Jews are seeing these two cartoons in Hebrew. And you also see it in English. We put it on our English Facebook pages. So hundreds of Israelis every day are being exposed to this message which is very important in Israel. And we're going to continue to do this on important issues facing Israel. The cartoons, even though they're in Hebrew and in English, you see them in Hebrew and in English. You see us doing an English version, a Hebrew version. But the cartoons are going to be on subjects that confront Israel. That's what we're going to be concentrating on for the cartoons. Because we really have to reach the people of Israel. This is an urgent time where we have to reach them. Of course, we're still going to be doing things, particularly for English-speaking people, videos and other things. We're still going to be doing that. We're not going to give up on our campaign, on our English-speaking campaign by any means. But this effort that we've started with the cartoons really gives us a shot now at reaching many new people in Israel. And people that we haven't reached before. Because there's certain people that don't want to watch a video. For whatever reason. I'm sorry to see that. I think everybody should be interested in our videos. I think our videos are fascinating. But there's some people who don't want to see videos. And who don't like to go to YouTube. And who prefer this. But we found that huge numbers of people love to look at cartoons. And so we see young Israeli Jews coming to these cartoons. And seeing these cartoons. People we haven't seen before. And saying, you know, I never thought of it that way, and admiring and respecting our organization and the talent of Shlomo, something which they weren't exposed to before. So this gives us a whole new avenue, a whole new way to reach people. And I hope it turns, of course, into a tidal wave. I hope our cartoons gain momentum and we reach more and more people, and that our movement can grow and that our ideas can grow from this. But I think it's a real plus. I think this was very encouraging this past week. It's two cartoons we released just in the past few days, and I think it's very encouraging. If we could do a couple of them every week, I think that could really give us a boost potentially. At least the first two, I know, have given us a boost to our Facebook pages and have given us a boost. And are being shared and are being put in other places as well. So I know we're getting a boost from the first two, and I hope that we'll gain momentum from it. So I think this was very encouraging. I think it's good news, and I very much wanted to discuss it and share it with our great JTFers on this program. And so if you want us to succeed, and I know all of our great JTFers do, if you agree that we have to reach the people of Israel with our urgent message because we're the only ones that are really telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, if you agree that we urgently have to reach the people with this message, then help us. And there are a number of ways you can help us. First, when you see our cartoons in English and in Hebrew, you're going to see these cartoons, God willing, you're going to see us putting up these cartoons every week in English and in Hebrew on our forum, in the, you know, sticky threaded, it's going to be sticky threaded in the general discussion section. All you have to do is like the cartoons. If you can comment on them, that's also good. Like and comment and share them on Facebook. Also, share them on blogs and in other places. Publicize the cartoons as much as possible. Help us spread the word with these cartoons because they're something we can be proud of. Shlomo is very talented and these cartoons are clever. And it enables us to, in a clever way, spread our message. That's number one. Secondly, of course, we're going to continue to do Hebrew and English videos. When you see us doing Hebrew and English videos, please like, share, comment, favorite, and do all the other things you can do to spread the word about our videos, both on Facebook and on YouTube. And then thirdly, our forums and our Facebook pages, every time you put up interesting subjects, open interesting threads, and make interesting comments or responses, that makes our forums and our Facebook pages more attractive, so other people want to become involved, so that also can help, and does help. Fourth, last but not least, of course, is the financial situation. If look at the talent we produce and the clever ideas. If only we had a real budget, can you imagine what we could do to change history? Can you imagine how quickly we'd become a mass movement? How quickly we'd fill the vacuum that exists in Israel and become a mass movement there? And that, of course, would give us tremendous attention in the media even here, and it would make us a big movement here in the United States as well. Every contribution, every donation makes a difference. It helps us to reach more people. Checks, money orders, and cash donations sent to our post office box do make a difference. Please help us. Help us so that these cartoons will reach more people and that will make more people think will make more people think for a change and understand what's really going on here, because you never know. Sometimes people seeing clever cartoons, this could get them thinking and can move them in our direction and can make them consider why our point of view and why what we're warning about is so true. Because deep down, many Israeli Jews already fear that that the type of things we're warning about are true and already are concerned. And so we have to reach them. We have to reach them and give them hope that if we all work together and we build a movement, that we can stop the bad things and we can change things and we can actually move the Jewish people and the world toward final redemption. We can do that if we create a mass movement. But we have to do it person by person. We've got to get out there and reach as many people as we can. The more support we get financially, the more people we can reach. So help us. Please help us financially. Very important. And if you want to do it with your credit card, unfortunately, one of our two Donate Now buttons, I don't know how long it's going to be operative because PayPal will be operative. The one that we do with PayPal on the Hebrew page, there's a donate button on the Hebrew page that you can go to. That is still operative. Baruch Hashem, thank God. But the one on the English page, unfortunately, the company that's involved there has announced that they're no longer going to be involved with that type of business, that they're not going to be involved with accepting contributions online anymore. That's what they announced. So I don't know how long the Donate Now button will be operative on the English, on our English main page. But on the Hebrew main page, I think it is still operative now, but they announced that soon that they're no longer going to be doing that. They're not going to be in that line of business anymore. So we'll see. Maybe we have to find a replacement for them for the English page. But on the Hebrew page, you still have that Donate Now button that you can go to if you want to send us a contribution with a credit card. That's still certainly operative on the Hebrew page. Unfortunately, on the English page, the company announced, I don't know, for whatever reason, they announced that they're not going to be in that line of business anymore very soon. And so, God bless the great JTFers that are helping us. Your contributions do make a difference. We're touching the lives of people and reaching people with a message of truth. And by the way, English-speaking people also get these cartoons because we do it in English. We do every one of these cartoons we also do in English. So English-speaking people also get this message and learn about these subjects, and that's also very important. Help us. I know that you agree that it's important and you agree that it's vital and you agree that we can't be silent and you agree that we have to act now. Help us because the more people we reach, the more people we convince, the more good that we can do to make this a better world, God willing. And God bless the great JTFers that are helping us. Okay, let's go now to our questions. And I see we have some very interesting questions this week, by the way. I just browsed quickly through the questions, and I noticed that we have some questions that seem to be very interesting this week. Let's start out with the great Wandering Samurai 81, who writes, and I quote, "Do gays die younger than straight people?" unquote. Oh, of course they do. Of course they do. First of all, according to one study, 50% of homosexuals in San Francisco and New York, for instance, either have AIDS or have the HIV virus. Now, it's true that people don't die as quickly as they used to from AIDS, that now people can live 20 years, 30 years with AIDS. It is possible to live a substantial amount of time with AIDS because of all of the drugs that they invented. You know, they began a massive campaign to find a cure for AIDS, which they never did. They never did a campaign anywhere near the size of the campaign they did for AIDS. They never did anything like that for cancer, for heart disease, for diabetes, for any of these other diseases which they should be working for cures on. Instead, they decided to devote huge sums of money, private and public money, to find a cure for AIDS. And so people can live with AIDS much longer than in the past. It was a very quick death sentence in the past. Now people live with the HIV virus and they don't contract full-blown AIDS. Some people have lived 20, 30 years like that, some people now. So it is possible to live with AIDS. But people have to take what they call a cocktail of drugs to protect themselves every day. And those drugs are not good for the immune system and not good for the body. And eventually they cause side effects and other health problems. So the people who have AIDS will die younger. generally speaking, will die younger than people who don't. And it's not just people who have AIDS. Homosexuals who don't have AIDS, which is, I don't know how many, I don't know what the percentage is who do, and I don't know what the percentage is who don't, but there are homosexuals who don't have AIDS. But they have a disproportionately high number of other venereal diseases and other types of problems. Also, studies show that happy, contented, married people with families live longer. People who have children, people who have families, people who are happy and contented, people who are religious, live longer than people who are secular. Every study shows that. People who are religious are happier than people who are secular, for obvious reasons. I mean, if there's no God, then this world is a real nightmare. But if there is, then actually the world is a beautiful place. So, of course, straight people are going to live longer than gay people. Religious people are going to live longer than secular people, and so on. Obviously, that's gonna play out that way. We have another question here, and I quote: "P.S. Does a so-called entertainer like Chris Brown deserve the Yimach Shmo curse?" Unquote. Oh, absolutely. He's an evil, violent, woman-beating beast. He's an evil beast. Like most black men, he beats women. He beats his own girlfriend. And beats them until they have to be hospitalized. These are cruel, vicious, cowardly, disgusting people. And he is a cruel, vicious, cowardly, disgusting individual. He's always in trouble with the law. He's always fighting with people and assaulting people for no reason, over a parking space or over some other nonsense. He's always on probation and other problems for just attacking people and engaging in antisocial behavior. And he influences huge numbers of other people who listen to him and view him as a public figure and actually admire and actually young idiots that admire and respect this piece of garbage. And so he is a bad influence on large numbers of other people. He definitely deserves the Yimach Shmo curse. Absolutely. Yimach Shmo v'zichro. Thank you, Wandering Samurai. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, logic, and common sense, who writes, and I quote, "One, your thoughts on the Haredi army protest in Israel," unquote. Well, first of all, I don't believe that the army should force Haredim to enlist. I don't agree with the attempt to force them to enlist, and I think it's anti-Haredi prejudice. The Haredim are the black hat, yeshiva-type people who are not Zionists, generally speaking. But, you know, what type of soldiers are you going to get if you force them and threaten to put them in prison? What type of soldiers are you going to get? What type of army are you going to get? What type of society do you have when you do that? I don't think that's something they should do. So I'm against the attempt to force the Haredim to enlist in the Israeli army. I don't believe that's a smart thing to do. And it's something, by the way, that even the defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, doesn't want to do. And a lot of people in the military don't want this, you know. But the politicians who are pushing forward with it because they hate the Haredim. That's the real reason behind it. They don't try to force all the secular Jews in Tel Aviv that don't go to the army. They don't try to force them into the army. They all get out of it, you know, through all types of easy excuses. The majority of young Jews in Tel Aviv don't go to the Israeli army. You know, and the Jewish leftists, the vast majority of them don't serve in the Israeli army, the young Jewish leftists today. They don't serve in the army. And yet nobody tries to force them. So there's a double standard here, and this is just anti-Semitism. It's just anti-Semitism is basically what it is. So I disagree with this decision to try to force people to enlist. And now Dr. Dan writes, and by the way, I believe the Israeli army will easily meet its quota of how many soldiers it needs. It doesn't have to do this. This is completely unnecessary and just causes division and hatred among the Jewish people. Dr. Dan now writes, too, what will happen in the world with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and U.S. empty threats, unquote. Well, you put your finger right on the issue, Dr. Dan. The U.S. empty threats embolden dictators and terrorists and vicious people all over the world. Barack Hussein Obama is basically giving the green light to everybody to do whatever they want to do because they know that they can get away with it. Barack Hussein Obama has bluffed so many times, whether it was with Syria, whether it's with Russia, whether it was whether it's with Iran, he has bluffed so many times that everybody knows that you have nothing to fear from him. The only country that fears Barack Hussein Obama is Israel. The only country that takes him seriously is Israel. Bibi Netanyahu is the only leader that takes this vicious animal seriously. And he is, and there's no question he has a special hatred for Israel and the Jewish people, and he especially blackmails Israel. But what is he going to do to Israel? He's going to cut off the $3 billion in foreign aid? Big deal. That's only 4% of Israel's budget. Big deal. Israel could easily do without it. It would be the best thing for Israel. But the Israelis are the last people that take him seriously. Obviously, Vladimir Putin is not afraid of him at all, is not worried about him in the least. And Vladimir Putin is proving in Ukraine, as he again humiliates Obama, he's proving just how weak and pathetic Obama really is. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And now we go to our great friend Yemach Shmo, to John Kerry, who writes, and I quote, Ukraine Prime Minister Mykola Azarov, born in Russia but moved to Ukraine in 1984. Why would any Russian want to live in Ukraine where Russians are hated, unquote? Because in 1984, the Soviets, we still had the Soviet Union in 1984, and the Soviets had a policy of encouraging ethnic Russians to move to Ukraine. The Soviet policy was always to get ethnic Russians to move to places, to the republics, to places like Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Georgia, all of these places. They wanted ethnic Russians there and Russian-speaking people there because they knew that if they had a larger Russian population there, a large Russian minority there, it would be difficult to break away from the Soviet Union. So that was Soviet policy. That was policy that was started by Lenin and then continued by Stalin and Khrushchev and all the other Soviet leaders. So, you know, he went there because he saw opportunity for himself, and in fact it paid off. He figured that being an ethnic Russian, I think he's actually half Russian, half Estonian, but he understood very well that that you could get ahead by doing that, because the Soviet policy was to encourage Russians there and to push them ahead in Ukraine in order to make sure that Ukraine would never break away. So that's what he did, and it paid off for him. It paid off for him. Look how high up he wound up going as a result of it. Thank you, Yemach Shmo. And we now go to our great friend Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what do you think about what is happening with Russia invading Ukraine? Thanks, unquote. Well, I think right now Vladimir Putin is not going to back down. They're going to have a referendum. I could tell you for sure what the results of that referendum are before anybody even voted. I mean, I guarantee you, when Putin has a referendum, he doesn't lose. He never loses. He'll make sure that the referendum overwhelmingly shows that the people in the Crimea Peninsula is a part of. Crimea Peninsula, by the way, is a strategic section of the Ukraine that was once part of Russia, but that became part of the Ukraine. And now basically they want to break away, and people in the Crimea Peninsula want to break away. The Russian speaking people would like to rejoin Russia. And so Putin intends to annex it. Putin's goal is to recreate the Soviet Union. He is a KGB colonel who wants to recreate. He was a KGB colonel. Putin's whole thinking was shaped by his time in the KGB and by dreaming of the Soviet Empire. And he wants to be the person who recreates the Soviet Empire, who rebuilds the Soviet Empire. And so he wants to annex Crimea as the first step, and eventually he wants to swallow up Ukraine and swallow up all of these republics. Thank you, Joe Gutfeld. And we're now going to the great Lewinsky Stinks, Dr. Brennan Rocks, who writes, and I quote, do you think we'll see a mass conversion of Ukrainians to Pislam, unquote? No, the Ukrainians are not interested in becoming Muslims. The Ukrainians, they're Nazis, but they're Nazis who believe in the European version of Nazism. They're not interested in any third world version. Lewinsky Stinks now writes, and I quote, discuss some modern day Jewish miracles you have witnessed, please, unquote. Modern day, oh, well, there have certainly been many modern day Jewish miracles in our time. The 1967 Six-Day War was a spectacular miracle. I was an 11-year-old boy. I was 10 or 11. Was I 10 or 11 in 1967? I was 10 years old. I was a 10-year-old boy. But I remember the time, and I remember how you had the big maps on TV showing the whole Arab world surrounding Israel, and everybody thought Israel was going to be destroyed. They thought it was all over. They thought the Jews would be finished. They thought that this would be the Holocaust that would finally finish off the Jewish people. People really thought Israel was going to be wiped off the face of the earth because all the Arab dictators were promising to do that. And millions of Arabs were marching in all the Arab cities, chanting, Itbach al Yahud, slaughter the Jews. And people really thought that this would be the end. They thought little Israel can't prevail against all of this. And I remember that during the war itself, people were very worried. The first day or two, they were very worried because the Egyptian media and the Arab media was reporting great victories, and they're marching on Tel Aviv, and they're destroying the Jewish enemy. But in fact, it was all lies. And we finally knew by the third day, the fourth day, that Israel was winning. And finally, at the end of the Six-Day War, we saw this spectacular victory, this spectacular miracle, right out of the Bible. Five of you shall chase 100 of them, and 1,000... And 10 of ye shall put 1,000 of them to flight. I mean, we saw the predictions in the Bible all coming true. The Jews outnumbered 100 to 1, winning spectacular biblical victories against their enemies, victories that we haven't seen for thousands of years. We haven't seen miracles like this. So that was an absolutely incredible, and the Jews had leaders who were traitors. And the Jews didn't even want to win. They didn't even want, you know how the Jews are. They didn't even want to liberate Jerusalem. They didn't even want to liberate Judea and Samaria and Gaza and the Sinai. And Hashem, God, literally forced them, really, literally pushed them to do this. I mean, it was so miraculous. A people that doesn't want to win, a people that has such self-hating leaders, a people with such an insane mentality, and they win against another group of people who surround them and outnumber them 100 to 1, and the whole world is backing the Arabs because of the oil and because of everything else, because of anti-Semitism and everything else. The whole world's backing the Arabs. And this little nation wins outnumbered 100 to 1 in 6 days and quadruples in size in 6 days? I mean, where have we seen miracles like this? We haven't seen miracles like this for thousands of years since the days of the Bible. So we saw the Bible coming alive again in the Six-Day War. And of course, a second huge miracle that I saw was with Soviet Jewry. When an organization like the JDL, which I had the honor of running, which I had the honor of being the national chairman of, miraculously waged a war against the Soviet Empire and won, and forced them to open the doors and let all the Jews out. I mean, it was an incredible miracle. No one, when we started, thought that there was any possibility that could ever happen. No one. People ridiculed us when we used to say that that we're going to get all the Jews out of Russia. They used to ridicule us. They laughed. And so, and you know, if you don't believe in God and you don't believe in miracles, they were right. So I've seen these things happen over and over again. I've seen incredible things in our day. And we can bring those miracles back. We can do it again. If we become a mass movement, if we ever get the power, we can do those things again. And it'll be an inspiration for Jews and for righteous Gentiles throughout the world. Thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. Because, you know, if we do the right thing, and if we take the right stands, when you take a step in the right direction, God rewards you. The reward is great when people do what Hashem commands them to do. Thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. And we now go to the great Chicago Jew who writes, and I quote, your opinion on the term Christian Zionists, unquote. I think the term is very appropriate. There are tens of millions of evangelical Christians in the United States, and many of them, if not most, have very strong feelings of support for the state of Israel and for the Jewish people in Israel. So I think the term is an appropriate term. I think it's a term that's very fitting. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And we go now to the great LKZ, who writes, and I quote, "What does the Connecticut gun ban mean for America?" Unquote. Any restriction on the Second Amendment right to bear arms is bad for America. It's especially bad for minorities like Jews, because the Jews, the day will come when Jews need guns to defend themselves. But it's bad for all Americans, and it's bad for the United States in general. Any restriction on the Second Amendment is very bad news. Very bad news. All of these anti-gun laws in Connecticut, in New York, in Washington, D.C., in places like California, they have very strong laws that attack a citizen's right to bear arms. The laws are unconstitutional, but the courts have allowed them to enact these very, very fascistic laws that don't allow law-abiding citizens to defend themselves. It's very, very bad news, because the criminal will always have access to guns. They buy guns on the black market, but a law-abiding person, if you take away his access to guns, because he's going to obey the law, and so he's not going to have the guns, you take away his access to guns and you give only the criminals guns, obviously that's making for a society that is very dangerous. LKZ now writes, and I quote, "Will NATO do something about Russia?" Unquote. No. If NATO, in other words, military action? No. NATO will, I do not believe NATO will take military action against Russia. No. I do think the United States can announce that they're going to do their missile defense program again, which is what they should do. You know, Obama announced he's canceling all the missile defense program, which the Russians were very much against. They were very upset about that. They didn't want the missile defense program. They were very upset that there was a missile defense program that Ronald Reagan wisely put in place. And so Obama and Hillary Clinton, the two traitors, announced that they're going to cancel it because they're going to have what they call a reset with Russia. They said they're going to have a reset button. You remember Hillary Clinton went with a big reset button and met with the Russians, holding a big reset button? Yeah, the reset meant that they were going to get on their hands and knees and let Russia step all over the United States. So they should build a missile defense system in Poland, the Czech Republic, and other places. That they should do once again. But actually taking military action and confronting the Russian army, I don't think that they're going to do that. No. LKZ now writes, "Is Islam involved in Ukraine?" Unquote. I don't think Islam is the issue here. No. Islam is a very serious threat to world peace. And nobody is more vigilant in exposing the Nazi nature of the Muslim terrorists and the Muslim dictators than we are. But this is a case where I don't think you can say that this is something that's created by Islam. I don't think so. And now LKZ writes, "Is Naftali working with Lapid?" Okay. Naftali Bennett is certainly working with Yair Lapid. He formed an alliance with him as soon as the election was over. Absolutely. And that means that Naftali Bennett from the Jewish Home Party, who claims to be religious, is betraying the people who voted for him. Because Yair Lapid is anti-religious, like his father was. His father was an anti-religious, sick, Judenrat traitor, and he's an anti-religious Judenrat traitor. He's an anti-Semite. Lapid, and like his father, like his late and unlamented father, the Lapids are anti-Semites. They hate Judaism. They hate the Jewish people. They were born Jews, but they're anti-Semites. They're Jewish anti-Semites. And Naftali Bennett is indeed working together with him, and that's a disgrace. That's a disgrace, and it should tell us a lot about Naftali Bennett. Thank you, LKZ. And we now go to our great friend Kalman Ben Menachem, who writes, and I quote, "Reb Chaim, Putin is playing hardball. Obama is playing wiffle ball. Your thoughts? Thank you," unquote. That is exactly what's going on, Kalman. I agree. I think some of it is because Putin wants the Soviet Union to become an empire. He wants the Soviet empire again. He wants to recreate the Soviet Union. And Obama is not an American patriot. He doesn't love the United States. Obama's not loyal to the United States. He hates this country. He thinks this country is racist and oppressed his people. You remember what his evil, ugly wife said? His evil, ugly wife said, "For the first time in my life, I'm proud to be an American." You remember she made that statement? In other words, she was ashamed to be an American until they decided to put a black Muslim in the White House. That's the only thing that made her proud. I mean, these are people who hate the United States. The people who run the United States now are people who are disloyal to this country, who hate the United States. So how can you win in a situation like that when your leader is a traitor? How can you win? That's what the American people are getting after they twice voted for this monster to be president of the United States. Thank you, Kalman. And we now go to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, "If or when the jihadis in Syria will beat Assad, do you think they will fight Israel next? How will they do if they do?" Unquote. I certainly think that they plan to. There's no question about that. They openly say that. I mean, they don't make any secret that they intend to fight against Israel, to destroy Israel. They're part of the same pattern. Not that Assad also doesn't want to destroy Israel. He also does. But Assad, because he represents the minority Alawite wing of Islam, the Alawites are Shia Muslims, and the vast majority of Syrians are actually Sunni Muslims, and so he represents a minority sect in Islam, so he is constantly faced with problems of disloyalty and rebelliousness and being hated by his own people. So Assad has a hard time fighting against Israel for that reason. He did go in the 1967 Six-Day War. His father went to war with Israel, and in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War, his father also went to war with Israel, so... You know, there will be times when they'll do that. And he also, of course, backs Hezbollah and the Hezbollah terrorists attacked Israel. So there's a danger from Assad. There's no question about it. He poses a danger, especially because he's always going to try to prove his devotion to Islam and to the Arabs and try to win over the Muslims and Arabs that are against him by going against Israel. So there's no question. There's a danger from him. But if the Al-Qaeda elements that are fighting against him take over Syria, I think the danger will be even greater. I think having because the Al-Qaeda elements represent the vast majority of Syrian Muslims who are Sunni. And if they take over in Syria, I think you're going to have a very hot northern border for Israel, and I think it'll be a very serious problem. I think Israel will face a serious crisis. I would hope we'd have real Israeli leaders that would be able to deal with that. If you had a real Israeli leaders, they would just conquer and liberate most of Syria, because most of Syria doesn't have any right to exist. It belongs to, it's part of the land of Israel. But we don't have real Israeli leaders, so it's a dangerous situation. Tag Mechir now writes, and I quote, "Perush Hamakabi Shiur, please," unquote. Okay, Perush Hamakabi is, of course, the great book of Moreno Verabenu, our teacher and our leader, Harav Meir Kahana, Zecher Tzaddik VeKadosh Libracha, Hashem Yikom Damo, may the memory of this saint be immortalized, and may God avenge his blood. One of the things Rabbi Kahana wrote about was Isur Achilat Chelev. Isur Achilat Chelev is the prohibition for eating. The chelev is the hard and tough fat in an animal. There's hard and tough fat in an animal, and in Hebrew and in the Bible and in the Torah, it's called chelev. I don't even know what you call it in English. I don't know if there's a special name for this hard and tough fat. Something I honestly don't know. But I know in Hebrew we call it chelev. And we're not allowed to eat it. The Torah specifically, it's a mitzvah deoraita. It's a mitzvah from the Torah itself, from the Torah bichtav, from the written Torah, that we are not allowed to eat the chelev of an animal. We're not allowed to eat the dam. The dam is the blood, and we're not allowed to eat the chelev. And the reason Rabbi Kahana explains that the reason for this, and he quotes many sources and does it beautifully as always, is because the chelev, the fat, tough part of an animal, it represents the pride of an animal. The strength and pride of an animal. And so we can't eat it, and we're required to sacrifice it because we don't want to show pride. We are supposed to exhibit anava, humility before God. And so we shouldn't be eating things that represent the ultimate example of pride. And so when we do animal sacrifices at Beit HaMikdash, at the Holy Temple, Shibana bimhera b'yameinu, which means it should only be built again in our time. Amen. When we do the animal sacrifices again at Beit HaMikdash, at the Holy Temple, we're not allowed. We must sacrifice the chelev. We're not allowed to eat it. And it's not just for korbanot. Korbanot are the animal sacrifices. It's also for chulin. Chulin means eating meat, not for sacrifice at the temple, but just because you want to, you want to have a steak or you want to eat some meat. If you're just eating meat for chulin, you're also forbidden to eat the chelev. And so there's a tremendous importance that Judaism and the Torah makes a big issue of this. I mean, it's in more than one book of the Torah and several of the parashiyot. We're repeatedly admonished not to eat the chelev. So anava, humility, is something of tremendous importance. Jews should be humble before the Lord their God, and should be humble in general, Jews as individuals. We should be humble. We should remember what we are, that we were created from the earth, and we're going to eventually return to the earth. We should be humble, and we should live our lives like that, because that is the appropriate way to look at the world and look at life. When you look at the world and look at life with humility, you're better able to perform the mitzvot, the commandments, the way you're supposed to. You're better able to relate to your fellow human beings the way you're supposed to. You're better able to relate to God the way you're supposed to. And so humility is a very, very important characteristic in Judaism. And that's something Rabbi Kahana brings to us with numerous sources in Perush HaMakabi. Thank you very much, Tag Mechir. And we now go to our great friend Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "Discuss one Peace Island, quote-unquote, massacre by a Jordanian Nazi soldier. For Adar 2 is the 17th Yahrzeit. Do you remember when it happened?" Unquote. Well, of course I remember when it happened. It happened in 1997. And I remember it very well. A Jordanian soldier opens fire and attacks 7th grade and 8th grade Israeli Jewish schoolgirls. 7 of the Israeli Jewish schoolgirls are murdered, and 6 others are seriously wounded. And he did it on the Peace Island. They called it the Peace Island because this was territory that was originally in the hands of Israel, and Israel handed it over to Jordan as part of their so-called peace treaty. And so this soldier murdered 7 innocent Israeli Jewish schoolgirls who came to visit with their class, and he just slaughtered them. Now, what happened to the Jordanian Nazi soldier who committed this mass murder? He was immediately proclaimed a hero in Jordan. The Jordanian justice minister called him a hero. They put him in so-called prison, but the prison was like a 4-star hotel, and the whole country bows down to him. The Jordanian justice minister called him a hero. The Jordanian parliament called him a hero. The Jordanian parliament unanimously passed a resolution calling him a hero. Can you imagine the whole Jordanian parliament unanimously passed a resolution saying that this guy who massacres 7 little schoolgirls is a hero? That's the type of scum that we're dealing with. And Jews still say we have peace with Jordan and Jordan is moderate. I mean, are you kidding me? The officially controlled Jordanian news media calls him a hero. Always calls him a hero. So, I mean, who are we kidding? The minute Jordan has a chance, they will join with all the other Arab Muslim Nazis to try to destroy Israel. We should never forget that. And we should never have given even one grain of sand from the Holy Land of Israel to the vile Muslim Nazi enemy of the Jewish people. Never. Binyamin now writes, to Gal Amir from Afula, unquote. Gal Amir, yemach shmo v'zichro, may his name and memory be obliterated. Gal Amir, he is the Hebrew Wikipedia Bolshevik piece of garbage. He runs Hebrew Wikipedia. And you know what he did to me and to us, to our movement, our Hebrew movement? Someone put up an article about our Hebrew movement. It wasn't even someone who was a member of the Hebrew Forum. Someone in 2007 put up an article about our Hebrew movement and put up an article about Chaim ben Pesach on Hebrew Wikipedia. He immediately removed the article about our movement, but he said he all right, Chaim Ben Pesach, he said he was the head of the Jewish Defense League, and, you know, he does a lot of videos, and there have been news articles about him. We'll leave an article about Chaim Ben Pesach on. That we'll leave on. And eventually he broke his word after promising to do that and removed even the article about Chaim Ben Pesach. There is no mention of Chaim Ben Pesach or the Hebrew movement or anything having to do with us anywhere on Hebrew Wikipedia. He removed any trace of anything having to do with us while he put up every radical left anti-Semitic and Muslim group that he supports and that he's part of. He put them up all over the place on Wikipedia, very positive articles, groups that openly call for genocide against the Jewish people, openly call for Israel's destruction, those groups he praises and puts up on Wikipedia. But Chaim Ben Pesach and Hayamin Hamiti, which is our movement in Israel, he removed any trace of that. Not only that, there were people on Wikipedia that had nothing to do with us, Israelis had nothing, and who objected to this and said, hey, wait a minute, you got to give these people also, I mean, you know, what is this? This isn't supposed to be, we're not supposed to have this political bias here, what's going on here? He banned every single one of them, people that had nothing to do with us, people who didn't even agree with us, but they felt that it was wrong to just, you know, blacklist us just because you don't like what we stand for. They felt that's not what Wikipedia claims to be impartial, which we know is a lie, they're not impartial. He banned every one of them. That's Gal Amir, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro. That is the left are crypto-Nazi scum. They act just like the Nazis. They have no tolerance for any other opinions. They have the same level of intolerance as they are like little Nazis, these leftists. And Gal Amir is an example of this crypto-Nazi mentality. By the way, we did a video in 2007, which someone put up again a few months ago. I don't know who did it. I'd love to know who did it, but someone put it up again on YouTube. I saw it recently again. It's called Moetzet Hachazirim Shel Wikipedia. Moetzet Hachazirim Shel Wikipedia means the Club of Pigs of Wikipedia, which was a video that we did against Gal Amir in Hebrew. If any of you understand Hebrew and can go find it, it was a very amusing video. It was done by Oz, who was one of our great admins on the Hebrew Forum. Thank you, Binyamin, and I'm glad that we're able to expose people to what's going on at Wikipedia. And we now go to our great friend Gimatria, who writes, and I quote, Chaim HaTzadik, have you heard about Professor Joy Layden? She is the first, quote, openly transgender professor, unquote, at an Orthodox university, YU. Gimatria, you have no idea how much I hate YU. I mean, that whole university is such an abomination. I remember 25 years ago already, they allowed a gay club at YU. A gay club. Now, Hashem in the Torah tells us that this is a toevah, that this is an abomination. And they allow a club for abomination at an Orthodox university? I mean, what an evil institution YU is. It's just an evil institution in every way. And now they have this professor, who was a man. His name was Jay Layden. And now he calls himself Joy Layden because he had reassignment surgery because he was assigned male at birth. This is how they speak. This is the new type of speak that they have. He was assigned male at birth. So he decided he didn't want that, so he had surgery. He had surgery to chop off his you-know-what. And to become a woman now. A supposed woman. And so he's a transgender. He's now transgendered. And he decided to come out of the closet and be transgendered when he knew that he had tenure. I mean, I ask all of our great JTFers, well, you already know. But what is wrong with this picture? I mean, is this normal? I mean, this is so, so sick. How could it get sicker than this? How could it get sicker than this? And what type of Orthodox university would allow filth like this? I mean, scum like this to be a so-called professor. I mean, it's just first of all, even before he was with the transgender Mishigas, even before he was with that insanity, He was always, a nasty, disgusting person. I mean, he has a history. But, they should never have allowed him to be a professor in the first place. But it just shows what we're dealing with here. I mean, it just shows, this is a complete betrayal of everything the Torah stands for. Thank you, Gematria. And we now go to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, "Please discuss Michelle Obama's comments in which she basically said that U.S. Jewish organizations sold out Israel in order to support BHO's goals," unquote. BHO being Barack Hussein Obama. EB, you know how much I like Michelle Obama. I think she's fantastic. And look how pathetic the situation is in this country. Look how pathetic. She's not a member of Congress anymore. She decided she didn't want to run again because she had to run such expensive and difficult campaigns. It was so hard for her to get reelected because of all the idiots in her district that opposed her. I mean, the people who supported her, I applaud, but there were a lot of idiots who vigorously opposed her. I mean, she was one of the few voices of sanity in the Congress. And now she's not in the Congress anymore. And of course, Michelle Bachmann, for those who don't know, she's not Jewish. She's an evangelical Christian. And she says what all the Jews would never say. No, Jews would never say what she said, that the Jewish organization sold out Israel to support Obama's goals. No Jewish leader speaks like that, except for JTF. JTF says those things. But except for us, no one tells that truth. And it is so obviously true. So obviously true. I think Michelle Bachmann is a wonderful leader. I hope she gets back into the political arena. I think she's very truthful and wonderful, and I hope she continues telling the truth about these Judenrat traitor organizations who stabbed 6 million Jews in the back during the Holocaust, who stabbed Soviet Jews in the back, who stabbed American Jews in the back, causing assimilation and intermarriage in this country, and who are stabbing Israel in the back. I hope she tells the truth and exposes all of them. Thank you, EB. And we now go to our great friend Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, can you explain why in the first two chapters, Parashat Bereshit, there are two different accounts of Hashem creating man," unquote. Okay, Maimonides, I thought that's what you were referring to last week. I know you asked the question last week, but I wanted to make sure because there are other... It's not just the first two chapters. The so-called Bible critics mention other things. I wanted to make sure that I knew exactly what you were referring to. Okay. Bereshit, by the way, is the book of Genesis. And what Maimonides is referring to is the first chapter speaks, for instance, the first chapter of Genesis speaks of the creation, Briyat HaOlam, and of creating plants and so on and so forth. And the second chapter also speaks of that. But there seems to be a different order in when man was created as opposed to the plants in the two chapters. Okay, and there's a reason for that. There's a very clear reason for that if we carefully look at the text and if we look at the context of what's being written. The first chapter speaks of creating the plant world, for instance, in the world in general, in the whole world. In the first chapter, it's speaking about how God created plant life and vegetation throughout the world. The second chapter is not speaking about that. The second chapter is speaking about the creation of plants in Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. Specifically in the Garden of Eden, not in the world as a whole, but just in the Garden of Eden for Adam, for Adam. Only in the Garden of Eden. So what the first chapter is speaking of in terms of creating plant life is different from what the second chapter is speaking of. The account of creation in the first chapter is speaking about things that are different from what is being referred to in the second chapter. Completely different things. And so these are two different acts of creation. Also, the plants created in chapter one existed, but were not yet grown and developed. If you see the language, you'd have to see the Hebrew language and understand the Hebrew language. But they just existed, but they had not yet grown and developed until Adam was created until Adam was created. Why? Because this is a world of tikkun, correction. Tikkun means correction. We are put into an imperfect world with problems and difficulties deliberately. Because if we weren't, what would be our point of being put into this world? We're being put in this world so that there are difficulties and there are things that have to be created. And that's our challenge. That's why we're in this world. And so the plant life in chapter 1 existed but had not yet grown and developed until Adam was created, because Adam had to grow and develop the plants. Symbolically, of course. I mean, we're speaking symbolically here in general, by the way. This is symbolic. The purpose is to teach us morals and to be a guide for us in life. But we see that people have to be in the world in order to grow and develop the plants, in order for them to flourish. That's the moral of the story. That the plants are really in the world to service humanity and for us to make them flourish and to grow and develop them. That we are partners with God in the creation. God creates the plants in the beginning, but then we have agriculture and we develop them and we create all types of wonderful, beautiful, magnificent things. Because God gives us the power and the ability to come up with great creative ideas as part of Tikkun Olam, as part of the correction of the world. So that's the second issue, is that the plants existed but had not yet grown and developed, because we have to grow and develop the plants for them to flourish. And the third issue here is that Chazal, the rabbinic sages, consider Gan Eden to be a spiritual place. Most of Chazal, not all of Chazal, but most of Chazal, most of the rabbinic sages, and we're supposed to follow the rabbinic sages when it comes to reading the Torah, most of the rabbinic sages consider Gan Eden to be a spiritual place, not a literal physical garden. Gan Eden being the Garden of Eden. It is not a literal physical garden. It is a spiritual place. And Adam Vechava, Adam and Eve, were spiritual beings. So the creation in the Garden of Eden in chapter 2 was spiritual, as opposed to the physical creation in the world described in chapter 1. Those are two different levels of creation. One was on a spiritual level, and one is on a physical level. And I could get into all types of sources on why Harambam and why Maimonides says this, and other great rabbinic scholars say this. But that is also a difference between the two, the creation in chapter 1, the creation in chapter 2. Chapter 2 is spiritual, chapter 1 is actual physical creation. And a fourth issue here. The Torah is not a science book and not a history book. It's a book that God gave us to guide our lives. God doesn't speak about molecules and electrons and protons and neutrons in the book of Genesis. That's not the purpose. He's not giving us formulas and telling us that water is H2O. And this is not the purpose of the book of Genesis, or of any of the books of the Torah. The Torah is supposed to be a moral guide and a spiritual guide for us in life, explaining to us why God put us into this world, what God expects from us. That is the purpose of the Torah. So if people are looking for scientific or historic, there are certain historic things. There are certain accounts of history that are true in the book, in the Torah, but that's not the purpose of the Torah. That's not the purpose of the Torah is not to serve as a science book or a history book. And I'll give you a fifth explanation here. Okay? There are intentional contradictions in the Torah. Yes, there are contradictions in the Torah. And they are intentional. In this particular case, I don't think there is a contradiction between chapter 1 and chapter 2. But there are other places in the Torah where there are intentional contradictions in the Torah. Yes. When we see the simplest and most obvious contradictions, sometimes we see the simplest and most obvious contradictions. I mean, it says one thing, sometimes in the same sentence we see contradictions in the same sentence. The simplest and most obvious contradiction. It's not because the writer of the Torah made mistakes and didn't know what he was saying, or got lazy, or because he didn't notice he was saying things that are contradictions, or because God, God forbid, made mistakes. That's not why there are contradictions. The writer of the Torah is just as aware as we are when we see these simple and obvious contradictions. They are deliberately put in there Because this is a world of contradictions. God created the world full of contradictions. Because this is a world of tikkun, of correction. There are contradictions in the world. There are conflicts in the world. There are unresolved issues in the world. And if God didn't include them in the Torah, then the Torah would not be a real book to guide us. If everything in the Torah was consistent and wonderful and just like one person writing everything straight through exactly the same way, then you would know for sure that it's not a real book of God and a real book about the world. Because, you know, that anybody can do that. Anybody can write a book, a brilliant book, and it's completely consistent and completely and straight through. It's the same. But if this is a world of contradiction and the Torah is a guide for the world, then those contradictions, manifestations of those contradictions in real life have to appear in the Torah as well. A book written without contradictions wouldn't reflect reality and wouldn't reflect the truth about creation. If there weren't contradictions in the world, then there weren't contradictions in creation, the world would be perfect. We'd have nothing to do in the world. We wouldn't have any challenge. So those contradictions deliberately are placed in the Torah. They appear in the Torah because the world is a world filled with contradictions. I hope that in some way answers your questions, Maimonides. And we now go to the great Mensch, who writes, and I quote, 7 million Ukrainians fought Nazis in the Red Army. 1.4 million were killed, while tens to 100,000, almost all from Western Ukraine, collaborated with Nazis, unquote. Mensch, I'm surprised that you're writing this, because this is whitewashing what the Ukrainians did. The Ukrainians were Nazis, and it wasn't tens of thousands. The vast majority of the Ukrainian people supported the Nazis when they invaded the Soviet Union in 1941. It's true that there were millions, the figure 7 million, I haven't seen such a high figure. I thought it was more like 4 or 5 million, but it's true that there were millions of Ukrainians in the Red Army. They were drafted. They didn't have a choice. They were drafted into the army by the Soviet Union. And when they thought the Soviets were winning, they had to fight on the winning side. They didn't have much of a choice. Also, those who really fought vigorously and were killed in battle, most of them were actually the Russian-speaking Ukrainians, were actually ethnic Russians who lived in the Ukraine, in the eastern Ukraine. In places in the eastern Ukraine where you see many Russians living, and those Russians, of course, considered themselves to be a part of Russia. But the Ukrainians who were not Russian-speaking and who were not planted there by Lenin and Stalin before World War II. The native Ukrainians, overwhelmingly supported Hitler and Nazi Germany. Many of them also were drafted and fought in the Red Army. That's true. But there were many desertions and there was a lot of disloyalty in the Red Army and there were all types of problems. The Ukrainian police and the Ukrainian civilians are the ones who rounded up Ukrainian Jews to murder them in Babi Yar. It was the Ukrainian Nazis who rounded the Jews up and made it possible for the Holocaust to be perpetrated against Ukrainian Jews. With the help of the German Nazis, of course, the Wehrmacht, Yimach Shmam V'Zichram, the German Nazi army. But the Ukrainian civilians and Ukrainian police and the Ukrainian authorities assisted the German Nazis enthusiastically. When the tide started turning against the Germans and the Germans started losing, many Ukrainians decided we better go back and support the Soviets again because we're going to lose toward the end of the war I'm speaking about. But the fact is, and of course, as I said, there is a very large minority of Russian ethnic Russians who are not Ukrainian, who live in Ukraine. But they're actually ethnic Russians. They are loyal to the Russians and to the Soviet Union, and they of course did fight in the Red Army loyally for Stalin and for the Soviets. But the Ukrainian majority in the Ukrainian majority in places like Western Ukraine, They fanatically supported the Nazis, enthusiastically. They had huge marches and demonstrations in universities and in the cities, and parades welcoming the Nazis and giving them gifts and bringing them fresh Ukrainian bread and flowers, and marching around with swastikas. And they murdered hundreds of thousands of Jews, including about 100,000 just in Babi Yar, in the Babi Yar massacre. So please, let's not engage in Holocaust revisionism here. Let's not whitewash what the Ukrainian Nazis did during the war. The Ukrainian people were party to the worst crime in human history, the Holocaust. Many of the Nazi concentration camp guards were Ukrainian. The Ukrainian police, almost to the last man, supported the Nazis and rounded up Jews. Ukrainian civilians turned in Jews. There were exceptions. There were some exceptions, because you have righteous Gentiles in every nation. There were some exceptions to the rule. You had a couple of Ukrainian priests who got up and said, this is wrong, we can't do this, and one of them, in fact, was sent to the gas chambers and murdered. There were some exceptions. Just as there were exceptions, even among the Poles and the Austrians and the Russians, the Poles, the Austrians and the Germans, who almost unanimously supported exterminating the Jews, but there were exceptions in all of those countries. There were a handful of righteous Poles, a handful of righteous Germans, a handful of righteous Austrians. There were always some exceptions to the rule. You're always going to have, from free will, you're going to have some people who choose to do the right thing, who choose to do the moral thing. And the same thing happened in Ukraine. There were Ukrainians who risked their lives and in some cases were murdered trying to save Jews. But that was very rare, very unusual, very unusual, just as it was very unusual for Poles or Germans or Austrians to do that. Very unusual. Very unusual. I mean, that's just a fact of history. All right, Manch. Anyway, the Ukrainian, and by the way, the Ukrainians to this day honor the Nazi, the Nazi puppet regime in Ukraine. To this day, they're honoring that regime. We're not talking about tens of thousands. We're talking about the majority of people in Ukraine support the new Ukrainian government, and the Ukrainian government do things that honor the Nazi puppet regime during World War II. And that honors some of the Nazi war criminals. And try to cover up and whitewash. And this is what, you know, you're unfortunately repeating a lot of the whitewashing. I know that you're a good person, but you're repeating some of this whitewash here and what you're writing here. That's just historically that it is not true. When you paint a picture of the Ukrainians as if they were overwhelmingly against the Nazis and supported the Soviets and the Russians, it's just not true. That's just not true. Yes, millions of them were drafted into the Red Army and fought in the Red Army. And some of them because they felt that the Soviet, and especially toward the end of the war, they felt the Soviets were going to win. But the claim that the Ukrainian people were against the Germans and against the Nazis during the war, the Ukrainian people as a whole, the vast majority supported the Germans. Thank you, Mensch. And we now go to the great Kahana loyalist who writes, and I quote, "Dear Chaim, whatever happened to your old co-hosts from QPTV, are they still active?" Unquote. Some of them are. Yitzhak, who was one of my co-hosts on QPTV, made Aliyah. Ruven, who was one of my co-hosts on QPTV, is still active with us. He's still very much involved with us. I speak to him all the time. I just spoke to him last night. Yosef Ben Meir and Sean Riley, two of the other co-hosts, both passed away, unfortunately. Aleihem HaShalom, they should rest in peace. They both passed away. Sara Batzvi has been very sick. She's in her 80s now. She's in her upper 80s now, and she's very sick. She had all types of very serious illnesses. And David Ben Moshe, who was, of course, one of my regular co-hosts. He's not a co-host anymore because he left New York City. He moved out of state to another state. Because he couldn't stand the taxes and all the oppressive bureaucracy that Mike Bloomberg was imposing in New York, so he left New York. And so because he's far away now, we can't do programs together, but, you know, we're certainly still in touch, and H. Dina, who is his wife, is actually still active on our forum. And Connor Loyalist writes, is Jimmy Sullivan still active? No, he's involved with family affairs right now. Thank you, Kahana Loyalist. So I think that's pretty much all of the old co-hosts. I think that's almost all of them. Yeah, I think that's almost all of the old co-hosts from QPTV. Thank you, Kahana Loyalist. And we now go to the great Imaknik, who writes, and I quote, is the Democratic and Republican Party just two sides of the same coin? Should the U.S. have more political parties, unquote? On most issues, they are. You see on the issue of amnesty, for instance, that they are. I mean, when it comes to amnesty for illegal aliens, Rand Paul, Jeb Bush, all these candidates for president, they all support amnesty for the illegal aliens. Ted Cruz is the only guy, the only presidential candidate, the only one who has taken a principled stand and doesn't budge and has been uncompromising on that issue. And on many other issues. On many issues, they are the same side. They are two sides of the same coin. I still feel that Mitt Romney would have been better than Obama. Even though I didn't like Mitt Romney. I opposed him when he ran for the nomination. But I still think he would have been better than Obama, certainly in terms of Iran. He would not have done what Obama's doing with Iran. And that issue alone, the danger of a nuclear Iran, on that issue alone, it's worthwhile to elect a different president. I don't think he would have been pressuring Israel to commit suicide with this obsessive pressure that we see from Obama and the Jew-hater John Kerry. I don't think that he would be, and he certainly would not be pursuing the Obamacare disaster, which is very damaging to the American economy and to the American healthcare system. So I think Romney was a lesser of the evils. I think he would have been a lot better than Obama. But still, it's not what we really want. Should the U.S. have more political parties? No, I think the two-party system actually works very well in the United States right now, if we could take over the Republican Party. If not, then we have to consider our options. But I think our goal should be to take over the Republican Party. I think that's what our goal should be. Thank you, Imaknik, and I want to thank everybody for another show that I very much enjoyed doing. Until next week, shalom.